This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. Welcome to the Science Podcast for September 16th, 2016. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, Lizzie Wade discusses why a researcher in Australia is burning pig bodies in order to understand what happened in Mexico to 43 missing students. And David Grimm is here with a roundup of stories from our daily news site. We could not produce this podcast without the help of listeners like you. Become a member of AAAS, the world's largest multidisciplinary scientific membership organization and publisher of the Science family of journals, before September 30th and receive 20% off your membership. Visit AAAS.org/save to become a member today. Now we have David Grimm, editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. Let's start with your story, Dave. This is about an interesting debate in the history of dog domestication. The question is, did domesticated dogs help people hunt? What's been the evidence for that so far?
Well, surprisingly, there really hasn't been much evidence. We just sort of assume, we know dogs were domesticated probably somewhere between 15 and 30,000 years ago. And this is a time where people were hunter-gatherers. So we sort of figured, well, as soon as the dog came along, because we were hunting, we must have used dogs to help us hunt. But there's really very little evidence for this. The best we can do is say, well, we've got old dogs in places where we know people were hunting, so seems like dogs may have been hunting, but that's about as good as we've gotten.
So your story takes us to Japan, where a researcher has been able to dig up evidence to support the hunting dog story. What did she find?
Well, it's a bit more figurative because she was actually looking through the literature. But what she did was she was looking at this culture called the Jomon, and these were people that lived on the Japanese archipelago from about 16,000 years ago to about 2,500 years ago. And what was interesting about them is they were sort of divided into a few different groups. The Jomon in the north sort of lived off the sea, and the Jomon in the south lived off the sea, but the Jomon in the middle on Japan's main island, Honshu, really lived off the forest. And at first, this was a pretty cold forest and had like a lot of really big animals like bison and mammoth. But as the world began to warm, the forest changed, and all of a sudden they started to see more smaller prey animals like deer and wild boar. Now, we know that Jomon had dogs, and the question was, well, if people really were using dogs for hunting that long ago, you know, maybe 10, 12,000 years ago, this is around the time when the world was warming, then maybe they would have given the dogs a special status in their society, because all of a sudden these dogs would have been very valuable to hunt down prey like deer and boar, and maybe dogs wouldn't have been as valuable to hunt down something like a mammoth, or certainly not to help us fish.
What did she find when she went and looked to see if dogs had been given this special treatment?
What she saw was evidence of about 110 burials that took place between about 9,000 years ago and 2,500 years ago. And these are all dog burials. And what's really interesting about them is the dogs are buried very much like people were buried at the time. They were buried basically in these giant piles of shells called shell middens. And the dogs were sort of arranged very purposefully. They were sort of arranged like they were kind of sleeping. Some of them had grave goods like antlers or bracelets buried with them. A lot of them also had what appeared to be hunting injuries, broken bones, broken teeth. And some of these injuries had healed, which suggests that somebody had taken care of the dog after it was injured. Putting all this together, the researcher sort of makes this assumption that, well, we'll only see burials at a time when dogs would have been really needed as hunters. They appear to have some hunting injuries. She also found an ancient bell that had an engraving on it that showed a Jamon hunter, what appeared to be a Jamon hunter hunting boar with dogs by his side. And so she sort of puts this all together and she says, you know, this is really the strongest evidence we have so far that dogs really do seem to have been used to help us hunt in these very early days.
And there's also this kind of sad part of the story that at a certain point they stopped treating dog bodies this way.
Right. So it seems like this relationship with dogs was kind of ephemeral. When we really needed dogs as hunters, we really revered them. But about 2,500 years ago, all of a sudden the burials stop. And what's interesting about this time point is this is when farming really takes over the region. So you would expect hunting becomes a lot less important, which means dogs become a lot less important. And we stop seeing burials. In fact, we start seeing a lot of evidence of just sort of scattered dog bones and butchered dog bones, which suggests that people may have started eating their dogs.
This is what happened in Japan. It looks like the evidence is getting a lot more strong for there. But what about other parts of the world? Can this story be told differently depending on where you are?
Yeah, it's a great question, and we don't really know the answer to that. But we do know that, you know, there were similar things happening in other parts of the world with the world changing, with prey species changing. And so I think one of the next steps is to look to see if some of that correlates with dog burials elsewhere around the globe.
Now we have a story on whether we should seed other planets with life. Here's the proposal. Send a probe loaded with an artificial intelligence and bacterial payload to visit exoplanets. The AI inspects the planet and then evaluates how lifeless it is and whether it could sustain life, and then adds the bacteria onto the lifeless ones. Who is proposing this, Dave?
Well, this is a theoretical physicist in Germany named Claudius Gross, and he's got this idea for something he calls the Genesis Project, and it's sending microbes to planets that we think are habitable but not inhabited in the hopes of sort of spreading life throughout the galaxy.
And then that's just the next question right away. Why would we do this? What would be the advantage? What would we get out of it? Or is it just, let's do it so that we can, you know, perpetuate life throughout the universe?
You know, one of his main points is sort of more of a sort of philosophical point that we should, as humanity, you know, we may not be here forever, but we should leave some sort of legacy behind. And this is one way we can do that, by spreading, maybe not ourselves throughout the universe, but spreading, at least giving the universe a little bit more life than it has right now.
Let's get into some of the technical details here. How would these probes get to exoplanets? None are very close to us, right?
No. And, you know, one of the first things is, first of all, to identify which planets are actually habitable, because you wouldn't want to obviously spend a lot of time and money sending a probe somewhere that is full of lava all over the surface. And so you got to find the planets first. And then he wants to use something called solar sails to accelerate. And this is actually part of a mission that's currently being developed called the Starshot mission, which plans to send probes to Alpha Centauri in search for life in the coming years. So some of the technology is there, although it still would take a long time to get to some of these places.
And then let's talk about the planets themselves. How could we tell a planet was habitable but also lifeless? Isn't there a danger that the introduced life would supplant a truly alien life form?
Yeah, you certainly don't want to seed life on a planet that's already got life on it. You don't want to sort of outcompete what's already there. And so one of the things the probe would do was is look for the amounts of oxygen or carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which might give a clue that there are living organisms on the surface.
You know, those are signals for the kind of life that we're used to. But I guess we wouldn't look at planets that couldn't support the kind of life that we're used to. So if there was life there, it would most likely be in this model.
Yeah, it is a bit anthropocentric because we're sort of assuming that if there's life out there, it's going to sort of resemble the life that we know about. And it may be a completely different kind of life, in which case the probe may not be tuned correctly enough to sort of figure out whether there actually are organisms on the surface.
One thing we can talk about then is the practicality of all of it. I mean, how long would all of this take? Designing the probe, it's not made, getting to a planet, and then, of course, establishing life there.
Yeah, you know, well, first of all, Gross thinks that this project could be launched somewhere in the next 50 to 100 years. But you could be talking about hundreds of years to get to a planet, then seeding it with organisms, and then waiting thousands or even millions of years for something to evolve on that planet, something to evolve beyond sort of the microbe stage, or maybe even billions of years. So this isn't anything we would probably see the results of anytime soon.
You're a sci-fi fan. I think I've seen a couple episodes of Star Trek that have a similar theme. Do you think this is a good idea?
Probably not. I think I'm an advocate for sort of the prime directive, isn't that sort of leaving the universe alone, trying not to interfere so much. And also, I think it's just kind of a bummer to know that none of us are going to be around to see the fruits of this project.
Before we go on to the next story, I wanted to mention an email that we got about a previous show. TT from Sweden wrote in and wanted to know more about Dave's comment on dog versus cat research. We've covered this on the show before, but Dave, can you talk a little bit about why it's so hard to study cats and what your experience has been discussing this with researchers?
Yeah, well, you know, so the context of this was this story we discussed on how dogs sort of understand language. And I think, Sarah, you had asked me the question of why we haven't studied this in cats. And this is sort of the perennial problem of, for those of us who love our pets, of why we know so much more about sort of how the doggy mind works versus the feline mind. And a lot of this gets chalked up to the idea that, as any cat owner knows, cats don't like to go into scientific laboratories. They don't like to participate in experiments. They're not really interested in helping us solve these mysteries. Dogs are a lot more amenable to this type of work, which is why we tend to see probably for every 10 dog studies that come out, we maybe have one cat study that tells us a little bit about cat behavior or cognition. And that's sort of the reason, unfortunately.
Thanks, Dave. And don't forget, you can always write to us with comments or questions at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. Lastly, we have a story on predicting space storms. Space weather can cause widespread damage to the electrical grid, but it has been difficult to predict when and where. Dave, can you connect this for us? How can space weather affect us here on the ground?
What happens is that storms of charged particles from the sun can crash into Earth and send electrical currents surging along power lines. And this can melt transformers and trigger blackouts. And there was an event like this that happened about 150 years ago called the Carrington event, where a space storm electrified telegraph lines across North America and Europe, and even burned some telegraph operators. Scientists estimate that if something like that happened today, it would cause about $2 trillion worth of damage.
And what's happened now is that researchers have kind of come up with a map of part of the U.S. that says, here is a risky area, here is a lower risk area. And there are two factors that make a region especially at risk. One is its actual location with respect to the poles. How does that affect risk?
Places that are at higher latitudes, the shape of Earth's magnetic field causes space weather to have a bigger impact in these places. And so the higher in latitude, the more sort of vulnerable you are to these types of storms. But there's another factor as well. It's that some areas of Earth's crust are actually more conductive than others. And what we do know is that the parts of the United States, especially in the upper Midwest, is home to two types of rock that together create a perfect opportunity for electrical currents. That's why scientists are saying that the map they created really puts places like Minnesota and Wisconsin in the crosshairs, because they're at these more northern latitudes, but they've also got this type of rock that's really sort of vulnerable to these types of storms.
Now that we know that there are these areas that have a higher level of risk, what can be done?
Well, one thing is to expand the map a little bit, because the map isn't really comprehensive at this point. It doesn't cover all areas of the U.S. and certainly not all areas of the world, to sort of figure out where the real vulnerable places are. And then once those hotspots are identified, engineers, power operators could really try to make sure that the grids in these areas are reinforced, that they're properly protected from this type of hazard.
Okay, Dave, what else is on the site this week?
Well, Sarah, speaking of space, we've got a story about whether or not we are lost in a directionless universe. Also a story about how dinosaurs used camouflage. And for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about how U.S. presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump differ in their response to science policy. Also a story about who is getting left behind in the internet revolution. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, the quiz, and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Two years ago, 43 students disappeared from a teacher's college in Guerrero, Mexico. Months of protests and investigations have not yielded a believable account of what happened to them. The government of Mexico claims that the students were killed by cartel members and burned on an outdoor pyre in a dump outside a small town called Cúcula. Lizzie Wade has been following this story with a focus on the science of fire investigation. Lizzie, can you outline what has been confirmed about these students' disappearance?
Sure. There's not a lot that we know 100% for sure. But what we do know is that on September 26, a bunch of students from this teacher's college called Ayotzinapa Rural School hijacked some commercial buses to take them to a protest in Mexico City, which is a pretty common practice at these schools, which are pretty politically radical. And they pulled into the town of Iguala eventually, and then there a bunch of them disappeared. Some of them escaped after they came under fire by someone, maybe right. Local police, maybe cartel members. There's some suggestions that federal police may have been involved, but nobody really knows what happened in the town that night. Basically, the government started investigating, and they came to the conclusion that the mayor had called this local cartel called the Guerreros Unidos, who then kidnapped and killed the students. And under interrogation, some of the members of that cartel said that they had burned the bodies in an open-air fire in a dump in Cúcula. And that would have happened the early hours of September 27th. And a couple weeks later, when a lot of attention was being focused on this case, bags of human remains that were basically ash were found in the dump and in a river nearby.
And those were matched up with individuals that were missing, right?
Yeah, so those were sent to a lab in Austria, and they managed to extract DNA from one student for sure, and probably another one, you know, DNA from the bodies that they were able to link to one or two individuals based on getting DNA samples from their families. But, you know, there were 43 students supposedly burned, and one or two after months of work is really not a lot. There was almost no organic matter left to do those kind of tests on.
And that's the open question that you've been looking into, whether or not the scenario of all these bodies being burned in a dump is possible. What are some of the reasons that experts didn't buy this idea?
So it started out by questioning the methods of the investigation itself. So there's these independent investigators from Argentina who specialize in disappearances, and they were monitoring the investigation, and they weren't there when the bags of remains were found. So they, from the very beginning, really questioned the chain of custody of the evidence, which is incredibly important for a state-of-the-art forensic investigation. You have to know really where these things came from. There's also the likelihood that the cartel members who confessed, did so under some form of torture, which we know does not yield reliable information. So their story was always sort of questionable from the beginning. A couple months after this all sort of came to light and people were questioning the story, this group of international experts got together to evaluate the investigation and do their own. And with that, they called in a fire scientist named Jose Torero, who teaches in Australia. And he looked at specifically the mechanics of a fire and whether a fire that big could have happened in the Kukula dump. So he went to the Kukula dump last summer and he saw no signs of a big fire, you know, some like burned plastic here or there, no burn marks on trees, which, you know, you might think that a burn mark on a tree would disappear like almost a year later. And, you know, it's true that branches and leaves can, well, obviously grow back. But when tree ring scientists, for example, they can see burn marks from a huge fire hundreds of years later, sort of stored in the rings of the trees. So like that still would have been there if the fire had been as big as the government and the cartel was saying. And he also, based on the state of the remains, particularly this question of there being almost no organic matter left, he just didn't think it could have been created by an open air fire.
So that's when he thought maybe this is a crematorium that was used?
Yeah, so it looks much more like what would be created by a furnace. So when you have an open air fire, the fat serves as fuel, but at a certain point, there's not enough fat to keep the fire alight. So the fire goes out and there's still organic remains left on the bones.
Okay.
In a crematorium or some other kind of furnace, you can keep a temperature steady that doesn't depend on the fat. The fire doesn't depend on the composition of the body. You can just keep it going as long as you want.
But one of the things that the researchers ran into here is that there isn't a lot of data on like how long it would take or how much fuel you would need if it was an open air fire. What was available?
So it was pretty kind of circumstantial. You had to do a lot of extrapolations based on studies that were occasionally, people have done studies that kind of burned one body at a time. Some of them were kind of anthropological, looking at kind of ancient cremation practices, things like that. So you can see, you know, how, what would you expect remains to look like if it was burned on an ancient pyre? But that stuff isn't the kind of data you want to get out of a study like that. Isn't the same kind of data you need for a forensic investigation, you know? So they didn't really have a step-by-step look at what happens when you burn one body at a time, how much wood you need to reduce it to various states of ash. What they really didn't have was what happens when you burn more than one body at a time, and especially up to 43 bodies at a time.
Right. So the next steps were to do an experiment and get some reasonable figures. What kind of setup did they use to figure this out? I mean, they weren't burning bodies. Let's just start with that, right?
Yeah, they did not use human bodies. They used pig carcasses, which is a, you know, a common proxy. Pigs and humans are quite similar anatomically. So they're often used as proxies in these kinds of experiments. So what they did was burn pig carcasses. They started with the pig's body weight in wood. So that's about 70 kilograms, more or less. And then they did twice that much, three times that much, four times that much, up to nine times that much of wood, and saw at each step what the remains looked like after the fire had burned out. They did this process with up to four pigs at a time.
After doing a bunch of these different configurations and repeating the experiment, what did they find out about the likelihood of the students being burned in the dump?
So it remains extremely, extremely unlikely to the point of being impossible. Even when they went up to nine times the body weight of a pig in wood, which is about 700 kilograms, there was still some organic matter left on the bones. This does not resemble the remains that they found in the dump and in the river. And if you think about, you know, multiplying 700 kilograms by 43 bodies, that is an insane amount of wood that is just not available on short notice in a small town.
Right.
Or to anyone, really. The big question was, once you start adding more bodies, do you need more fuel or do you need less fuel? Because maybe the bodies themselves contribute some of the energy and you need less wood to burn them than you would if you just like multiplied the figure. Once they started adding bodies, it became really clear that the more bodies you add, it sort of dampens the fire and you need even more wood. So like that 43 times 700 figure it's not even enough if all the bodies were burned at once.
Oh. Is this data set going to be useful for anything else? Is the research team going to say you can use this to investigate other types of fires and murders?
So yes, they definitely want it to be useful to researchers looking at especially other forensic situations, although it is specifically designed to answer questions about this case. A lot of forensics is sort of based on intuition or people's past experiences, especially fire sciences, really lacks a lot of hard scientific data. And so this data could potentially be quite useful in investigating murders or arson, but it really is designed to be used in this one particular case.
So what about all the other unanswered questions with these students? Will there be further investigations because of this research?
I hope so, but the government has not been super willing to push on its own conclusions. So they've done two investigations themselves. It's a little bit hard to imagine them doing a third, especially when they have not responded well to Torero and others questioning their claims. The important thing about this research, actually, is that it doesn't actually tell us what happened to these students, which is obviously still the most important question. Like, it doesn't really tell us who killed them, how, if they were killed. There's mm-hmm. assumptions you can make, but the answers to what happened to these students are not in this dump. To find it out, you really have to start looking elsewhere. And what he wants to do is just get everyone to start looking elsewhere, to rule out this dump so conclusively that the investigation has to turn to something else. And whether that will happen, I don't think anyone knows.
Okay. All right, Lizzie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lizzie Wade is a contributing correspondent based in Mexico City.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org or tweet to us at Science Magazine. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and many other apps, or listen to us on the Science site. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.